from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, European leaders are expected to release a plan this weekend to address the growing sovereign debt crisis. But just yesterday, German leaders put a damper on hopes for a quick solution. What should be done about the economic crisis in Europe and how vulnerable is the United States economy? We take all that up next with your calls, emails, and your online questions and comments after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Time is running out for European leaders to resolve their economic differences and work out a strategy. 20 finance ministers have set the 23rd of October's Brussels-based summit as the deadline for establishing a plan to avoid Greek debt, bolster the banks, and curb contagion. The two-year-old sovereign debt crisis has once again put Europe and perhaps the entire global economy at serious risk of recession, or perhaps worse. And we want to spend this forum hour discussing the problems and the ongoing search for viable and sustainable solutions. We're going to be joined by James Galbraith, who is University of Texas Austin Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs professor. And we welcome you to the program. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Also want to mention that I was an admirer of your father's and, in fact, interviewed him many years ago and read the John Kenneth Galbraith, read The Affluent Society, and was quite influenced by reading that, along with Michael Harrington's The Other America. Just a little footnote to begin here.
Thanks very much for saying so.
And Michael Mandel is also joining us for the hour. He's chief economic strategist for Progressive Policy Institute, and that's a centrist democratic think tank. He was former chief economist for Business Week, and he's with us from the nation's capital. Welcome, Michael Mandel.
I'm glad to be here.
Glad to have you with us. Before we speak to Professor Galbraith and Michael Mandel, we thought we'd talk to Dan McCrum, who is with the Financial Times. He's U.S. investment correspondent, in fact, with the Financial Times, and joins us from New York City. And welcome, Dan McCrum.
Hello. Thanks for having me on.
We are glad to have you on. And perhaps we get a bit of an overview from you in terms of what the plan that's shaping up might be, or is there a plan?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because the thing to understand with Europe is there are sort of three or four intricately overlaid problems within this crisis. And at the moment, politicians seem to be attempting to tackle one of them at each time. So we have this big bailout fund, which has just been approved by all the various governments in Europe, called the European Financial Stability Pact. And the question is really, is this big enough to bail out Europe's banks? But then is it also big enough to bail out Europe's governments? And within that are overlay problems of what they're attempting to do and the willingness of the individual governments to back it for each individual aspect of the plan, which is a slightly complicated way of saying that Europe has a problem both with its governments and its banks, and it's not sure exactly how it's going to deal with both of these.
Now, the big problems seem to be boiling down to, on the one hand, dissension between France and Germany in terms of Germany taking the bulk of the onus of this financially, but also, of course, the concern over Greek austerity and the deeper recession possibly happening there and the vote that's impending in the Greek parliament. But I'm curious to get a read from you on that. We keep hearing Greece, 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 and yet there are many who are saying we should be more concerned about Italy and the markets there, or even about Portugal and Spain.
Well, the problem with Greece is that the government there is going to default on its debts. And it boils down to how bad is that default going to be? And what will be the ripple effects through the banking system of that happening? And also underlying that is a separate issue is the question of Italy and Spain. These are the third and fourth largest economies in the Eurozone. And if they can't meet their debts, then it's game over. We're into a very bad scenario for Europe generally in that case. And if Spain and Italy can be revived, protected, then that should allow them to underpin the banking system. And the question comes back to France and Germany, because they are the last two very solid sovereign governments that we have left in Europe. And it's the Germans are unwilling to backstop what they see as profligate spending by the Greeks and some of the peripheral countries. So they're unwilling to pay other people's debts, as it were.
Well, Chancellor Merkel wants to restructure that Greek debt, doesn't she?
Oh, she wants to restructure it, but they are wary of standing behind the whole continent's debts. And so they don't want to bail out Spain and Italy. And so we get into this very layered situation where there are lots of different competing objectives here. So the Germans want to bail it out, but they don't want to spend too much money. And they don't want to do it using things like leverage, because they're sort of allergic to almost the use of the term in the politics of Germany there.
Yeah, in fact, looking at an article by Hugo Müller-Vaug in the German magazine Bild, where he says, no thanks. If we bail the banks out, they'll have to pay us back with interest. Greed should not pay. This seems to be an attitude that's running through a lot of Germany as Chancellor Merkel and President Sarkozy kind of face off here in terms of what should be done in terms of recapitalizing the banks.
Well, Germany eventually... The Germans essentially face two very unpleasant choices. They either enter this problem of moral hazard, by which they bail out the Greeks and the debts of a lot of other people, or they allow it to restructure, and then that has a ripple effect through the banking system, which then has a knock-on effect on the economies there, which affects German exports. These are countries who Germany does a lot of its exporting to, so Germany will effectively be hindering its own economy out of a matter of principle. And neither of those choices are pleasant or politically popular.
Seems to be. I actually heard an interview you did with one of our public radio people from Alaska. Actually, it was on C-SPAN. And you were talking about the fact that the economies don't seem to work well together in the North and the South, and that there's been a good deal of what you described as fudging of finances, as well as reacting to events as they happen. All of that sounds... pretty seriously in the minus category in terms of getting this thing solved.
Well, you have the fundamental problem here that the European Union and the single currency are a political construct, and the economics of it were sort of assumed that they would be worked out along the way as part of this higher principle, which is greater European integration, which is a consequence of the Second World War, and it's been the guiding principle of European politics, I think, since then, towards ever closer integration. But at the heart of that, you have a couple of big problems, which is that the northern European countries are very export-orientated. They're very strong economies, and there's an emphasis, I mean, not to get too carried away with the idea of the Protestant work ethic, but there is less of an emphasis on debt, more on solid financial outlook on life. Whereas down in the southern economies, they suddenly were able to borrow at German rates. And so they went on a big spending spree, and they built up lots of debt, and they had these economies based pretty much on tourism and on ever greater debt, similar to some of the problems which we had here in the US. And those meant that the economies are fundamentally very different in terms of the way they're structured, the way what people can be paid. And normally what would happen is the southern countries would just devalue, and wages would adjust, and the economies would be able to adjust. But because of the political structure of the European Union, it's very difficult for that to happen now.
Talking again with Dan McCrum. He's with us from Washington. He is U.S. investment correspondent for the Financial Times. I guess the one final question for you, Dan McCrum. Mervyn King, governor of the Bank of England, says the current financial crisis is worse than the Great Depression, and that implies that we're all kind of connected together in this global economy. How vulnerable is the U.S., and is that overstating the fact?
I would honestly don't think that's overstating the potential negative consequences to the global economy as a whole. I think he has a very real grip on how these debt problems can slowly, it's not a question of spiraling, but they slowly compound upon each other as debt becomes more and more difficult to repay. And that is a global problem. And in essence, it's the result of two very big underlying trends, which have been the enormous amount of capital and savings there are in the world, which has created this glut of capital, and it's a more enormous amount of labor in the world as various different countries have, such as China, have entered the world economy, creating this glut of labor. And so we've moved very slowly but steadily over a period of a couple of decades to this point. And attempting to resolve these deep underlying trends is extremely difficult.
Dan McCrum, appreciate very much your being with us here this morning. Thank you.
Thanks for having me on.
Dan McCrum, again, is U.S. investment correspondent for the Financial Times. Let me go down to Texas and bring James Galbraith into the conversation. And again, he is a professor in the School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin, the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs. And Professor Galbraith, from your perspective, it's kind of reform or doom, at least as I read you. But what kind of reforms are we really talking about here, and are they on the horizon?
Well, they're not. I have just returned from Greece. The country is in a state of chaos. It's in a state, frankly, of dissolution. It's extremely grim, depressing to see the center of Athens, to see the beggars, the people who are the squeegee men, the people, the drug addicts sleeping on the sidewalks, the abandoned storefronts, to talk to people who are have had their salaries cut dramatically. University professors have lost about 40% of their revenue, of their incomes, while their taxes have been going up. It is a society being squeezed extremely hard. That said, the Greek government is not the entity that is going to take a decision to default on its debts, which are frankly unpayable and unsustainable. What is going to happen, and I think what is going to happen relatively soon, is that the flow of funds which has been permitting them to effectively register payments pass through new loans received back to the banks who hold their bonds will be cut off because the decision maker in the matter, which is the government in Germany, has, I think, come to the decision that they don't want, for political reasons, to continue this process of recycling and building up the Greek debt. And so what is being prepared in Europe is what will happen when that decision goes into effect, which may be, let's say, next December, when the next big round of Greek bonds matures and has to be paid off. And the German government's concern, and to some extent the French government's concern, is not so much the Greek debt itself, because it's a very small country and the banks can withstand the shock of writing down the Greek debt, but the knock-on effects. What will happen? What would happen if Portugal, Spain, and of course ultimately Italy, found themselves in the same position, or if they decided that they would like to have the same sort of deal, just as in Latin America in the 1980s when the Brady Plan came in, a whole series of countries wrote down their debts. And the problem there is that the European Financial Stability Fund is in no way adequate to deal with a cascading series of write-downs, including Italy, which is the seventh largest economy in the world. So what is happening here is that Greece is being made an example of. Essentially, the country is being, I think this is not too strong a word, is being destroyed in order to discourage other countries from following along the same route. And so what you have here is effectively the application of a principle which should have been abandoned a long time ago, which is the principle of collective responsibility. 13 million people being put through really severe privation, and it's going to get worse to the point where there is essentially no expression of hope or confidence in the country.
When you say severe privation, are you talking about this austerity that's been imposed?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You are looking at a country which had a European standard of living and the aspiration to rise toward the levels experienced in other parts of Europe, which is being driven back down into a dysfunctional economy and its sharp drop in living standards. And you're going to see the consequences in rising mortality rates, rising crime rates are already visible, all kinds of things. Breakdown of public services, breakdown of the health service, breakdown of education is going on now. These are not things which are reforms in any sense designed to give Greece a new economy. They are punishments designed to make Greece into such an unattractive case that the other countries that are in debt problems will knuckle down and continue to service their debts. At least that's the hope of the Germans. I think the chances of it succeeding are nil to next to nil.
James Galbraith with us from Austin, Texas. Again, is a professor in the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas. Michael Mandel is chief economic strategist for a Progressive Policy Institute, and that's a centrist Democratic think tank. He's also former chief economist for Business Week, and he's with us again from the nation's capital. I know you see things somewhat differently, Michael Mandel, but let's talk about the mismatch between, on the one hand, debt, and on the other hand, growth or lack of growth.
I think what you're seeing in Greece, in Europe, what you did see in the U.S., the overall big pattern is that the amount that, of debt that was taken on exceeds the capability of people and countries to pay it back at the current rate of growth. So the real question is, this is a debt problem or is this a growth problem? And I'm not sure that, James Galbraith wouldn't agree with me on this, that the big part of the problem is that we have a lot of debtor nations, and the debtor nations actually include all of Europe. This is what makes it hard. If you sort of, if you combine Europe together is running a trade deficit. And Germany is running a trade surplus. Pretty much all the other countries are running a trade deficit. They continue to build up debt. The U.S. is a debtor country. And what happened is that the rest of the world lent Europe and the U.S. a lot of money under the assumption that growth was going to continue. And what's happened is that growth has slowed, which means now there's a mismatch between the amount of debt and the amount of growth. When Jim talks about collective responsibility, unfortunately, the collective responsibility has to include not just debtor nations, but the creditor nations as well, which are countries like China and Russia and Saudi Arabia. Okay, so you get a small number of creditor nations, and the problem that we're running into at this point is that the countries that are the creditor nations that have been shipping goods and services on spec to the developed countries have been building up all of these assets, these claims against the developed world, and the question is, what's going to happen next? And I only see two ways out at this point. I'm looking beyond what's happening in Greece now. I only see two ways out. One way is innovation, and by innovation I mean things that actually accelerate the rate of growth in developed countries. And the other possibility is inflation. And inflation includes the depreciation of currencies, but it also includes anything that whittles down the value of the debt. And so the place we are right now is that the central banks are still trying to hold out against inflation. They're still trying to hold out against the fact that you just can't solve this problem the way it is. If your debt exceeds your capabilities of paying stuff back at the current rates of growth, something has to break. You can't just keep patching.
I noticed that Fareed Zakaria said the real problem is the lack of growth, which I think certainly significantly tied with what you just said. But how Bloomberg said that there's $3 trillion in euros to stop this crisis that's necessary. And how much can insolvent governments afford to pay that kind of money, and particularly in light of the fact that there's really no unified fiscal authority in
Wait. Don't stop thinking about Europe. Europe by itself is a problem. But remember, Europe is a debtor continent. Europe is running trade deficits with the rest of the world, and their biggest trade deficits are with China and with Russia. And so if you think about what's going on at this point, as long as you're running trade deficits with the rest of the world, your debt problem is continuing to increase. So you could fix today's problem. The problem is fixing tomorrow's problem and the day after. And where we're heading for at this point has to be a restructuring of global production and a restructuring of global consumption. And you know, I'm with James on this, is that, you know, making Greece kind of bear the brunt of it at this point is terribly unfair, because the fact is this is a global problem. But it's not a global problem that's going to be fixed with bailouts. The only way it can be fixed with is either accelerating growth, which means focusing on innovation, or whittling down the value of the debt through inflation, because you sure is not going to be able to do it through negotiation.
Well, it may be a world problem, as you're suggesting, but James Galbraith, somebody no less than George Soros has called for a common European treasury. In other words, joint savings bonds, that sort of thing. It was suggested by Patrick Legland. In other words, I get back to this question because I think it's significant in Europe, where there's unified fiscal authority. It's a deeply flawed system, isn't it?
It is a deeply flawed system. Soros' suggestions, which I know are intended to be constructive, are, in my view, neither necessary nor sufficient. the Europeans can handle their financial problems internally if they chose to do so. The European Central Bank is perfectly capable of providing all of the euro that are necessary to keep the system afloat. So I don't think that is, in fact, the question here. The problem is that essentially governments in Europe are, and particularly the decision-making governments, which are in Berlin and in Paris, are unwilling to take the steps that would be necessary, and they're partly constrained by an unwillingness to recognize the adjustments that might ultimately be imposed on their banking systems, which are extremely fragile and be held together with scotch tape and bubblegum, essentially, and with a series of misrepresentations about the strength of the banks. I mean, one of them that failed a few days ago, Dexio, a Franco-Belgian bank, had been rated as sounder than a great many larger banks in stress tests just a few weeks earlier. So you're looking at a very fragile banking system, which is a fact of which is continually being evaded and covered up in Europe. And you're looking at the political constraints on, particularly on Chancellor Merkel's government, where you have an enormous internal pressure to uphold the canons of financial respectability, not to bail out the profligate and all of that, in which you've got a fundamental problem, which is that there's a failure to recognize that the Greek and Portuguese and Spanish deficits are simply the other side of the coin of the German surpluses. The two things could not exist without each other. And the fact that there are these imbalances which have led to the great buildup of debt in the European periphery is as much a function of German policy, of the failure of Germany to run a balanced external trade policy, as it is of any decisions that are taken in those countries.
Forgive me, Professor Galbraith, but we're coming up on a break, and I want to just give the phone number and also go back to Michael Mandel for a second. Let me, by the way, invite those of you listening to join us. It's toll-free, and you can do that now at 866-733-6786. We do welcome your phone calls, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. You can join this conversation, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or post a question or comment on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or go to our Facebook page and post a question or comment. Michael Mandel, where's the U.S. figure in this whole picture?
The U.S. is facing the same problems as Europe is. We have a more unified fiscal situation, which kind of prevented a Greece-type situation from happening, but we're still borrowing enormous amounts from the rest of the world. We still have slow growth, and the next pressure for us will actually come on student debt, because the real wages of young college graduates has been falling even as the debt burden has been rising. And so the problems will come in a different form for us, but we've got the same problems as them. And going back to Europe for just a second, like I said, Europe collectively is running a trade deficit with countries like China and Russia. So even if Germany was to balance its trade with the rest of Europe, you'd still have the growth of debt. The real issue at this point is that the developed countries are not growing fast enough to support their levels of consumption. And so either we need to accelerate growth or reduce the levels of consumption. And there's really you can't escape that choice.
Well, the choice for you is to join the program. Those of you listening, in fact, we'll hear from you when we return. We're going to go to a quick break and then come back with Michael Mandel and James Galbraith. Entertain your questions and comments. And this is all about not only the crisis in Europe, but as you can plainly tell from Michael Mandel's comments, here in the United States and beyond. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. European leaders are expected to release a plan this weekend in Brussels, actually on the 23rd of October. And there's also, of course, another meeting set up in Cannes in France on the 3rd and 4th of November. But really what we're talking about here is the growing sovereign debt crisis. And German officials on Monday put a bit of a damper, to put it mildly, on the hopes for a quick fix. We're asking what should be done about the crisis. How vulnerable is the United States economy? Dan McCrum joined us earlier, U.S. investment correspondent for the Financial Times. And with us from Washington, D.C. is Michael Mandel, chief economic strategist for the Progressive Policy Institute and former chief economist for Business Week. And with us from Austin, Texas is James Galbraith, Lloyd B. Benson, Jr., chair in the government business relations and professor of government at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs, University of Texas. Actually, Professor Galbraith, just kind of an interesting footnote here and a compelling one. I was talking earlier about my admiration for your father, whom I interviewed many years ago. You have a daughter now who's out in the Wall Street occupation protest. Is that right?
Well, she's participated in it on a couple of occasions, yes.
Yeah, and you've expressed publicly that you're proud of that.
Of course I am, yes.
Yeah, okay. Just wanted that on the record. To feel the transgenerational feeling of the Galbraith family. Let me, in the meantime, go to your calls, and we'll go right to Bob in Mountain View. Bob, join us.
Howdy. Keynesian economics is not a theory. It's a reality. And if it wasn't for due to it, we've gone from what could have been 20% unemployment to the high nines, and now down to 9.1. And Obama's trying to bring it down even further with more stimulation. You can't cut yourself out of the economic mess you're in. You have to stimulate the economy. And I'm wondering, which is what you're trying to do further in the United States. I'm wondering if Europeans have a plan to stimulate the economy and just pump more blood into the system. Not money for people that aren't initiated, but for economic stimulation and to the middle class and poor who spend a dollar and a half for every dollar they get versus 40 cents for every dollar they get for the rich, which is what Obama's trying to do here and which is the religiously and philosophically against the Republicans' philosophies here, but what they're doing in that vein in Europe, because basically you can't cut yourself out of your economic mess. You have to make money, which means you have to stimulate the economy to stimulate.
All right, Bob, you're going into a bit of a screed here, and I want to get a response from our experts. And in fact, Michael Mandel, I think you've said that President Obama should restrain the regulators, which means, I suspect, more innovation and more open markets.
Well, let me just address the question of stimulation first. The stimulation is stimulation. The problem we have right now in the U.S., for sure, is that a lot of stimulation of consumer spending ends up flowing right out the door into Chinese-made products. And so you don't get as much bang for the buck as you think. In fact, what it turns into really is it turns into not more jobs in the U.S., but more jobs overseas. I'd prefer to focus on stimulation that is basically focused on investment. Investment in physical capital, investment in human capital, investment in knowledge capital. And I think that we should assume that it's going to take time for us to get out of this crisis. There's no easy way, and yes, we should spend, but it should be on things that are growth-oriented.
And let me go to you, Professor Galbraith. James Galbraith, I think you said we need particularly to strike some kind of balance between the private and public sectors. That's maybe the key to getting out of this morass we're in?
Well, it's certainly part of the key, but let me address the question that the caller asked about the European attitudes. What's going on in Europe is our major cuts in a government sector, which in most countries is 50% of GDP. And the European authorities are simply assuming that growth will resume in spite of those cuts. The reality is, as the caller said, that when you cut the public sector to that degree, the economy goes down. It goes down because the activity is directly affected by the cuts and because people's incomes are directly affected, so they are able to spend less in the private economy. So that in Greece right now, you're looking at a continuing fall of total output on the order officially of 5% per year, and people tell me that it's going to be at least 7.5% per year, which is rates comparable to the effect of the Great Depression in the United States. And the idea that there is going to be some rebound, some growth emerging from austerity, is a complete fantasy in the European context. In fact, what's going to happen is that these rates of decline simply mean that the debt burdens get worse. They simply become heavier on a smaller income base, and therefore you spiral down much more rapidly toward the inevitable default. And that's the situation faced in Europe. I frankly totally disagree with my friend Mike Mandel, who's in his emphasis on the external aspect of this, on the relationship with the Chinese and so forth. What we're looking at here is a combination of bad institutions, bad ideas, and toxic politics, as well as bankrupt financial institutions inside the European Union. It's an extremely complicated and extremely dangerous mess. And the major effect on the U.S., by the way, is on our financial institutions, which have derivatives exposure to Europe. There's a story in today's paper about how Bank of America has transferred some of its derivatives exposures from Merrill Lynch to an insured depository so as to protect that exposure and improve the credit rating of the whole operation. That could very well be an indication of their anxiety about the degree to which an American financial institution, in this case, is exposed to the risk of credit events originating in Europe.
Michael Mandel, you want to respond to this point of disagreement that you have that Professor Galbraith
just— This is really very important, okay? Because, I mean, when I say, I look out and say, who's the ultimate bondholders here? The ultimate bondholders here is, directly or indirectly, the Chinese government, the Saudis, the Russians. You just kind of go around and look at the creditor countries, and you sort of say, this is the place, these are the people who are ultimately holding the debt claims. Okay, and as he said, it gets complicated because what happens is that the banks are actually the funnel for this money into Europe and the U.S. So what happens is that the claims, many of the claims are against the banks, and the banks have the claims against countries like Greece. But I think I'm really dismayed to sort of hear that he disagrees that a big part of the problem is the way that globalization has turned out. Because one of the big surprises to me at this point, when I look at the U.S. economy, I say a lot of the stimulation has clearly leaked out the door. And part of the reason why it has been much less effective than economic forecasters expected was because of the effect of trade. And this is not saying that trade is bad. What it's saying is that we actually have to look really closely at the links between the U.S., Europe, and the rest of the global economy. Just like, in retrospect, it turned out that the Great Depression was not an American phenomenon, was not a European phenomenon, it was a global phenomenon. Right now, what's going on, the financial crisis in Europe is not a European crisis. The U.S. crisis was not a crisis around housing. This is a global crisis. We're all kind of connected together.
Well, here's a listener who says, managing the single currency over so many different countries with varying fiscal policies is becoming impossible. Monetary policy was relatively easy to cede to the European Central Bank, but control over taxation is not so easy to let go of. Are the parliaments and people of the Eurozone starting to realize the true cost of European integration in terms of how much national sovereignty they have to relinquish, and are they now backing off from it? What do you think, Professor Galbraith?
In fact, yes, the people in Europe are very agitated by the general failure of European economic policy. At the same time, they recognize in Greece and in Ireland that, to take two important peripheral countries here, that the difficulty of going back to the national currency would be extreme. People are accustomed to holding their money in a currency that doesn't depreciate rapidly. It would be very hard to move them to hold let's say the drachma, should it be reintroduced, because they would be afraid of a rapid depreciation. So you'd have a 1990s or 1980s Argentine situation on your hands. It would be very disruptive. It may well be, nevertheless, what will ultimately be forced on the Greeks, and then we will see just how disruptive it is. Coming back to the question of China, I don't think that there are any surprises in the extent to which we import from the Chinese or anybody else. Those parameters were well known, and I don't think they're unstable. And secondly, the increase in debts that's occurred in the crisis has largely been absorbed domestically. The exposures are, in the case of the sovereign debts of Europe, the exposures are to the first of all to the French banks, secondarily to the German banks and elsewhere in Europe, but the exposures to the French and the German banks are the primary policy considerations at the moment, because those banks, if there's significant write-downs that go beyond Greece, and particularly if they go to Spain and Italy, then pretending that those banks are solvent will become a practically impossible bit of sophistry and magical accounting.
Again, James Galbraith is professor of the LBJ School of Public Affairs, University of Texas, Austin. Just got back from Europe. Michael Mandel, you were talking about debtor nations and creditor nations. There's a comment on one of our listeners put up on the web. It says, why can't investments from nations flush with capital like Brazil and China help stabilize the situation in Greece, Spain, and Italy? Seems like the benefits of world economic stability would be worth the outlay of cash.
Yeah, well, if we were all under one government, that would be the answer. But from their point of view, they're sort of saying, why should we? We are poor countries. Why should we put our money in to bail out the rich countries? And ultimately, that's going to be the failure of this particular period, which is that it turns out that that the massive amount, it's really China, okay, that's holding the massive amounts of cash, and plus the oil producing countries, and it's going to turn out the inability to collectively decide how to apportion the losses on the debt is going to be the real problem. And what I would ask Professor Galbraith is, you know, where is the German and French banks raising their money from? I mean, the reason why they can't afford to take a haircut on the Greek debt is because they have obligations themselves to their funders, and it's those funders that actually matter as much as anything else.
Well, actually, I'm looking at a web comment here that says right on point. One of the listeners writes, "I understand that any potential solutions, rely heavily on Germany, but isn't Germany also poorly situated to provide help to other countries? I believe its debt to GDP ratio is about 80%, which I would think makes it hard for it to loan money to other bankrupt countries."
Yeah.
Well, the European Central Bank can do what it wants if it has the approval of the dominant stakeholders in the ECB. So this is a political question, not a question of an underlying lack of money.
See, I would agree.
But let me quickly say on China, the Chinese have in fact attempted to be helpful. They have made significant investments, by the way, in the port of Piraeus in near Athens in Greece, and they have been indicated a willingness to make other kinds of investments. But this doesn't come for free. And guess what? Both the U.S. and I believe the U.K. have objected to certain things that the Chinese would have liked to do with respect to Greece, which is a NATO ally. And that has blocked up, to some degree, the flow of funds that the Chinese might be willing to make. At the same time, if you were a Chinese financial official, you would be very reluctant to take a big exposure in Greek bonds at this point, because you know very well that they're going to take a haircut.
And you were going to say, Michael Mandel?
The European Central Bank for a second. I agree with James that, in fact, the European Central Bank should do a lot more. In fact, both the European Central Bank and the U.S. Central Bank should consider pumping a lot more money into the economy and be willing to accept some measure of inflation and be willing to accept some measure of depreciation of the respective currencies, because, in fact, that's the way to sort of whittle down the value of the debt. So I'm with him 100% that the European Central Bank could do a lot more, but I don't view this as a European problem. I don't view this as a U.S. problem. I view this as a global problem.
And then
I think there's no chance that you could get inflation out of more expansionary monetary policy. There's another issue, but there we are.
Let me bring Robert into this, who's been waiting patiently to have his say. Robert, join us, please.
Thank you so much, and thank you for your guests for this important program. I want to comment on Greece. I'm a professor of international finance and worked in Greece twice for a total of about 5 years as a banker. Your guest, I haven't heard any commentary on what I'll consider institutional problems in Greece. And those are an extraordinary pension program for an extraordinarily large percentage of the population who are government employees. Unions who have incredible power. When I worked in Greece, unions struck the banks for almost 2 years straight. And those problems continue to exist. Greece has had very difficult problems collecting taxes from its population. In fact, it's a national game, particularly amongst the ship owners, to avoid taxes in Greece. Greece has borrowed a lot of this stuff on itself, notwithstanding the Eurozone, notwithstanding the Euro. And I'm not hearing the commentary from your guests about some of those problems that the Greeks are responsible for.
Well, let's hear from our guests on that, because certainly Germany has made a great deal out of sort of the indolent attitude of Greeks and living off the dole and all those kinds of things. Comment from you first, James Galbraith?
What the caller says is certainly true. The Greeks, for example, it's extremely hard to tax the shipping industry. They're ships, after all. They can go headquarter themselves someplace else, and there's basically a political deal. That industry stays in Greece so long as it's not taxed. And, you know, you can talk about the other problems of governance. But in a credit boom, such as we had up until 2008, 2009, it is characteristic policy of the lenders to overlook these weaknesses, to put out cheap money to weak borrowers. And that's not just Greece. That is also true. It was also true of commercial real estate in Ireland. It was also true of housing in Spain. And it was true on a massive scale with respect to cash out refinancing of mortgages in the United States. This is the way the financial system operates in a period of euphoria and lax control. The weaknesses of the Greek governance were not a secret up until 2007. Your caller, who's worked there for years, obviously knew about them before that period. This was not widely known. So we are looking here at a problem where the responsibility has to be shared between the debtors and the lenders, and I would say on at least an equal basis. And when the resolution has to happen, it is essentially a question of decisions being taken by lenders and creditors to write off bad debts. Their refusal to do that and to make a claim of virtue, oh, we never knew that Greece was a poor country with a weak governance system and a big public service and aggressive unions, is preposterous. It's just preposterous, as indeed the very clear statement of your caller makes very clear.
Well, here's another clear statement from a listener on the web who says, so if countries shouldn't make cuts to government in a recession because it destimulates an economy, like President Hoover did, but don't want to make cuts during good times, a la President Bush and Vice President Cheney, deficits don't matter, when does government act to stay solvent? Will civilization ever find the right middle, or is the lesson that positive cash flow through a rising economy and the plateau they reach for a period of time thereafter the only times countries achieve successful economies and standards of living?
Can I address that?
Yeah, please.
You know, don't think about government spending as being undifferentiated. Okay, you've got government spending to support consumption and living standards, and you've got government spending to support investment. Really, we should be running our books in such a way that we can tell a difference between the two. In Greece, they were mostly let me just be really clear. Okay, I'm not an expert on Greece. Okay, but it seems like the most of the money was going to support government spending was going to support current consumption and not investment. If you think about how you might want to stimulate an economy, what you want to do things that leave a mark for the future. And I said this before, investment in physical capital, which is things like infrastructure, investment in human capital, which is education, investment in knowledge capital, which is R&D and everything that kind of comes along with it. Those are the things that you should be focusing on. And frankly, there's no reason to worry about running a deficit if that's what you're spending on. If you're spending on consumption and current living standards, that's more of a problem, because then you have to ask the question whether or not those living standards are supportable given the production levels of your economy.
By consumption and living standards, you're being inclusive in terms of Greece putting out all this money for, I mean, there was an extraordinary number of people who are working on the government payrolls.
Look, I'm going to be really blunt here, okay? I'm not an expert on Greece. What I know about Greece, I read in the newspaper, and newspaper stories, speaking as a former journalist, are not always right. I'd have to go and I'd have to sort of look myself at the data to sort of see what is going on there before I tar them with the brush of sort of saying they were overspending. But my sense is that there wasn't enough spending on investment, enough spending on, you know, my fellow speaker here sort of talked about how they wanted to sort of move up and sort of join the richer nations of Western Europe, and I sort of wonder whether or not to what they were doing to actually do that, what they were actually investing in. So I'm really in favor at this point to stop worrying so much about consumption levels and start worrying more about investment levels, because I think what we've seen over the last 20 years is being focused too much on consumption leads you down the wrong path.
And Michael Mondell is chief economic strategist for the Progressive Policy Institute. Yeah. All right, let me bring in on the banks. We get Chris on the air with us. Hi, Chris.
Good morning. This sort of fits into what you were just talking about. I read a very interesting article that one of the reasons that Germany is doing so well is a big chunk of its banking sector are state and municipal banks that are forbidden from investing in derivatives and real estate and all that stuff. And so there's a lot of capital available for smaller companies to invest in plant and equipment. And we used to have something like that in the U.S. I forget the name of the law, but Clinton got rid of it. I'm wondering what either of you know about the impact of the state and municipal banking sector in Germany on the economy in Germany.
Well, Michael Mandel or James Galbraith.
Well, Germany does have stabilizing institutions that come out of the social democratic period. I would be cautious about too strong a claim that everything is hunky-dory inside the German economy. Papers I read suggest that a very large proportion of the labor force is now in what the Europeans call precarious employment which is increasingly low wage and increasingly unstable. So the notion that we have over here that Germany is a kind of a great social democratic utopia or paradise with a large part of its labor force protected from the kinds of exposures that everybody else has, I think is a bit of an overstatement. Coming back to Michael's point about investment and consumption, I think we're in complete agreement that what we need is a strategic approach that deals with the problems that we actually have. And I would put energy and climate change and infrastructure and education the care for an elderly population very high on that list. But that does not free you from the risk of financial squeeze. You can do all the right things and still get in trouble on your debts. As far as Greece and its alleged profligacy, I'll just give you one example. If you're a senior professor teaching economics in Greece at the major university with almost 30 years of experience, you are presently earning 1,800 euro a month. That's less than $3,000 a month. That would be on the order of a quarter of what a professor at an equivalent institution in the United States would normally make. And your everything about your economic situation is squeezed. I do not see how in a world where people are mobile, you can hope to maintain a viable institution of higher education on that kind of a financial basis, or how it represents in any sense a profligacy which can be improved by further cutting. And that's just, in addition to that, I would say that the resources to support students and so forth that we take for granted in this country have totally dried up over there. So we are looking here not just at reforms of a previous period of profligacy. We're looking at institutions that were not strong to begin with, which are now being dismantled.
I don't suspect, or I hope that this is not a kind of monkey wrench, and it may be out of the bailiwick of both our guests, that is James Galbraith and Michael Mandel, but there was an article in the Rome La Repubblica by Andrea Bonini, and she said the truth is that the two major leaders in this, Sarkozy and Merkel, are kind of out of their depth. They don't have the skills for the roles they're trying to play.
They have. Angela Merkel is a politician of great skill, but her skills are as a politician. And she is in a deeply difficult situation in which I think her maneuvering room is next to nil. Sarkozy, I can't speak to. Perhaps he won't be president of France for all that much longer. But the fact is, the problem here is not the skill, it's the direction of policy. Neither of these leaders has a European vision. The whole spirit that animated the European Union 50 or 60 years ago has completely disappeared. Been taken over by a kind of a technocracy of what are essentially right-wing economic ideologues with very simple-minded ideas repeated constantly, and they're leading the whole system to a great crack-up. And
it may
not very
well
distant future.
Be that the European vision
Mandel.
May not be the right vision anymore. Okay, because kind of what we're looking at is the question about whether or not Europe as a whole is big enough to sustain itself in this new global economy. I'm not sure that countries that don't have high productivity, you know, should be having should be having their living standards sustained? It's a really interesting question. I'm back to the place where I was before. I don't see this as a European problem. If we got an economist to sort of to advise the French and the German leaders, we'd have as many differing opinions, more differing opinions than we have on this show right now.
However, what James Galbraith just said struck me because he mentioned right-wing ideologues, and this gets into political realm, and one wonders, there are those who are talking about the word contagion spreading over here with the Tea Party and all the sort of right-wing ideology that we're seeing being fostered in the United States. Is this, Michael Mandel, as you see it, pretty much a pervasive political problem?
Go back and ask that question again. I'm really not sure what you're asking here. I mean, we've got a fundamental economic problem, and the fundamental economic problem is that...
We also have a governance problem, though, don't we?
Well, if you believe we have a governance problem, it's because you think that there's a clear-cut response and that the stupid government is not able to sort of come together on this clear-cut response. And I don't happen to believe that. I actually think that there's a deep economic division about what's going on. Just like even now, there's a deep economic. You cannot get an agreement on what happened in the Great Depression. What we're discovering is that the tools that we thought would have been enough to sort of fight the Great Depression have not been enough to fight things now.
Have you read Michael Hitzlick's book where he says Roosevelt did many wrong things, but he did a lot of right things too, and it kind of comes down to the idea of spending more money, which goes along with...
In that case, it came down to the idea of spending more money. But isn't it odd that what we're saying then is that a set of policies that were appropriate for the 1930s and a very different global economy are still appropriate now? There's really no reason why that should be true. And partly what's happening is we followed, call it a weak version of Keynesianism. All right, there was aggressive stimulus, perhaps not as much as people would have wanted, but both the central bank and the Republicans and the Democrats moved relatively quickly, and the hope was that this was going to solve the problem. I really think that this is not the 1930s, that this is not a demand shortfall recession.
That's going to have to end it because we are flat out of time. But thank you so much, Michael Mandel from the Progressive Policy Institute, James Galbraith, from Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs, and Dan McCrum from the Financial Times. Appreciate all you, our listeners, being involved in this. And you can continue, by the way, going to our website, this conversation, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment or continue it on Facebook. Another hour of Forum up ahead, part of our first-person series. Stay tuned. For all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.